Andre, please tell me, what was the first time you actually enjoyed to play tennis?
When I was 27 years old is, I think, when I started to really enjoy the game, because it was never something I chose for myself. I gave myself the permission to quit, and then once I did that, I then tried to find reason to choose it. So I took ownership of my life by creating a way for me to enjoy the game, and that was by building my school. Mm-hmm. So when I had my team, my school back home in Las Vegas, I started to play tennis for this mission I had, and I started to enjoy tennis more. And then it just kept growing, you know, until even to this day it's growing.
And is winning with a team like that more easy?
And losing, because it makes sense what you're doing and what you're living.
I read your book, and one thing I really didn't understand is, how could you survive all that saying nothing? What helped you? Was it that you didn't want to reject your father, or what was it?
Well, I think different stages of my career is different reasons. I think initially it was just straight control. I didn't have a say. It was what I was supposed to do. And then it was fear of, you know, what would I do if I quit? What will I do? You know, and then it's, and I think I was, you know, it's not like you didn't have good things with tennis. You know, tennis came with a great life. I could take care of my family. I could take care of people, myself, all the needs. It's a big life, but that doesn't mean that you connect to it. That doesn't mean you care about it. That doesn't mean you would do it all over again. I did it for different reasons along the way, but I finally did it for myself when I was 27 years old and at the lowest point.
Oh, I bet there were many bad moments in your career too, but I remember it was 1995, I think, in Wimbledon, you lost to Boris Becker, and then he had kind of press conference when he was very personal towards you, talking bad things about you, and also, you know, how the people, how they don't like you. How could you support all that with having any damage on you?
Well, you take it in stride. It leaves a wound. I don't know if you ever really, you always have the scars of it. You always remember it. But you learn to forgive. You learn to move on. You learn to, to not take yourself so seriously. You know, but it's not easy. I mean, at the time, especially.
Was the book kind of therapy, or?
I think when I was finally done writing it, that's when the therapy kicked in. Because writing it, I had a goal. And like a tennis match, no matter how you feel, you put aside your feelings and you accomplish your goal. You know, and my goal was very focused. But when I was finished writing it, then it felt a bit cathartic.
And did you need somebody like to help you to go through that, or you just did it all by yourself?
I needed a lot of people, and I had a lot of people, and there are different people at different stages of my life, some people all the way through. But I think we all need people. It's hard to do anything alone.
Would you like to mention some of them?
Well, my trainer, Gil Reyes, for example, my coaches along the way. I needed Nick. At a certain time in my life, I needed Brad, I needed Darren, I needed my wife, Steffi, you know, so they all played an important role. Mm.
After publishing that book, it was Nadal, Federer, Martina Navratilova that made some strong comments on it, but were there any tennis players who were actually happy to have that, somebody who accepted it as a part of truth which must be spoken?
Well, I got a lot of support from a few players, definitely, the Bryan brothers being one of them. But, you know, it's not the most intelligent thing to have an opinion about something you don't know, you don't read. You know, and so I separated the opinions. If you read the book and you judged me for it, fair enough. That's your opinion, and you have the right.
I don't judge no one.
Yeah, but if you did, that's fine. You know, it's at least it's your opinion based on what you know. But those that didn't read the book, that had an opinion, this was hard for me to give credit to. As much as I respect Federer, respect Nadal, respect Martina, as a person, times we spent together, I can't respect the opinion on my book when it wasn't read. So I just kind of didn't think about it, really.
Did you get any reactions, let's say, from William's sisters, Jennifer Capriati, or other athletes which, let's say, have the same kind of fathers, like Pushy?
From people. I haven't talked to any athletes specifically, but I've talked to a lot of people that have read the book and said that they had the similar experiences, different but similar. So, you know, but I haven't spoken to any tennis players specifically about that. No.
Speaking about your college education, I think is the thing which gives you some choices. You said you didn't have choices when you were 7, 8, 10 years of age. Is that the reason why did you find the college?
Well, partly. I think that's a component of it. You know, just to be clear, I don't think any of us have real choice. You know, we none of us really chose our life. I mean, so much out of our control, where we're born, who our parents are, what education they can give us or not give us. You know, these aren't choices. These are what we're stuck with in life. And so I think the idea of learning how to take ownership of your life more than choosing it is really the important thing that I came to learn. And I think not having the education really compelled me to make sure I did everything I could to give the education to children that wouldn't be as lucky as me to be good at tennis or something of this nature. So I think that did play a part.
So the college has nothing to do with tennis?
No, my academy is strictly education and is strictly a result of me caring for children and also understanding my profound lack of education.
If I understood right, you have 1,500 kids waiting to get the education from your college. Did you expect it when you started 10 years ago?
No, because I thought, well, I didn't expect a waiting list. I expected kids to feel like this was a gift that was there. I saw a vision of culture. I saw a vision of education and direction in these children's lives and a safe haven for them. And I knew it would be a good place, those that went there. I just didn't know how big the need was.
And what are you going to do about it? It sounds terrible, like putting some pressure on you, but is this the last and the only college of Andre Agassi?
I've just announced us launching the Canyon Agassi Charter School Facility Fund, which is this fund that has impressed upon traditional capital the merits of investing in education. So as a result, I've gone out and raised and have to deploy over $500 million to build best-in-class charter schools across the country. So is it enough? It's not enough, but I'm not done. I think over the next 10 years, we can have billions of dollars invested in the future of our country for the kids and for the operators that know how to educate them.
Well, I hope for you.
Thank you.
Let's go back to history. I've seen you in David Letterman's show.
Yeah.
When he gave you that hairpiece.
Right.
And I was asking myself whether it is funny or not. How did you feel about that?
It's David Letterman, so I can't take him, I can't be too mad at him, but it just feels like a different life. You know, it's not mine. Yeah, hard to believe that's actually what I used to do.
For me, hard to believe was, you know, how somebody who has so many pressure on you could actually add his own pressure by wearing a hairpiece. Was it really that bad?
I was good at adding pressure. I didn't feel quite complete unless I added my own dose of pressure.
And was it really that bad? You know, you didn't think, what if the thing will fly away or fall apart? Or
no, I did. There were times I struggled with it a lot. There were times where it was malfunctioning, times where it wasn't so easy to hide, and I have to.
How did you actually put it on your head? You glue it?
They weave it to the side.
Yeah.
of the hair that you have. So okay. It's fake hair woven around to the side of the hair you have, and then your actual natural hair is pulled through it as well, so it blends together. But when your roots grow, it gets loose. So you have to keep doing this every, 6 weeks or so. And if you use the wrong conditioner, it really comes loose.
You revealed all your secrets in the book. Did anybody tell you not to write it?
The points of the book, there were points where people said that you probably should think twice about that.
Which points they were?
The admission to drugs, the admission to failing a drug test, the admission to lying about it. I've gotten some advice about things I talked about, how I felt growing up. With my father and the difficulties that I went through as a result of, family was telling me, you got to think about this. And I worked hard to make sure I treated it as a loving, honest portrayal. So, different points of the book were difficult for different people.
Hmm. When you started to talk about that drug episode, crystal meth, is it possible to play on it?
No, not productively. I mean, I think you would die. I mean, your heart is going so fast. It's not an enhancer. It's a inhibitor. It destroys you. You don't eat. You don't drink. You're very wired. Mm-hmm. And playing on it is, not.
So what have you been doing?
What do you mean?
Oh, well, when you took it.
It's everything. I would just... one thing drugs does is it removes you from... it makes you feel something. And that's what I was missing. I was in such a low point in my life that I didn't feel connected to my life. I felt like I was in depression. I didn't care about anything anymore, including myself. And when you take a drug, it makes you feel again. Even if the feeling is synthetic, even if the feeling isn't real, at least you feel, and so that's the addiction. In any drug, it makes you forget, and it gives you something else. It takes you away from the reality in your life, and so it didn't matter what I did; it mattered how I felt. Hmm. Sometimes I just go play golf all day. Sometimes I would clean the house all day. Sometimes I would take apart things and put them back together again, try to understand them, It didn't matter what I was doing. It was the way I felt, and it was the fact I wasn't thinking about my life.
I've understood you've broke some Wimbledon trophies, too. Does it give you any kind of special strengths to just put it apart? Or?
I don't think it gives you a false sense of strength. So you feel brave. No, you feel brave. You feel like you can do anything. I can, but it's not, your body isn't capable of it. The breaking the trophies is a result of hating the life you've lived, and that doesn't take much strength at all.
And physically, is it difficult to break the trophy?
No,
you just smash it against the wall.
Yeah, the trophy falls to the floor. It can break. I mean, it can bend. So it's not hard to do.
Let's go to 1997. That was probably the worst year for you. How did you find your way back? I don't want to believe that somebody can do that by himself.
No, of course not. No, you can't. It's every day. I mean, it took me 2 years to get back. 1 year of falling apart and 2 years to make up for it. It was a decision that I made that every day I would choose to make myself a day better. And that's the one thing I knew I could do. I didn't know if I could get back to number one. I didn't know if I could ever really be content with my life. But I knew I can be more of myself tomorrow than I was today. And I would take off these bite-sized pieces of goals. And I refused to give in.
Oh, well, I know a lot of people who actually live the life which they haven't choose right now. If you could send them a message at the moment, what would you tell them?
I would say just because you haven't chosen your life doesn't mean you can't take ownership of it, doesn't mean you can't find reason